I forgot to mention, when a wave of manifestation arises from the unmanifest, the first thing it, well, I'm reiterating a little bit here, but the first thing it does is go into the field of Rajas, which is the balance, the dividing line between yang and yin. And then so it rises to the zenith, and then as it falls, that's the path of Shiva, destruction, transcending. And when it reaches the nadir, that's represented not by a guna, but by Purusha itself, because Purusha is the fourth guna. It has, since there's no representative in creation to represent Purusha, it has to represent itself. And so it represents itself when everything is at the lowest point of activity. When we transcend in meditation, when creation goes into pralaya, the night of Brahma, when everything goes to sleep, at the least state of excitation, that's when the transcendent is contacted, and so the transcendent represents itself at the nadir of every wave. And then it rises to become the next wave, and that's Brahma, the creator, creating the next surge. And when transcending occurs, that's the time that most likely change will occur. But it's also the time that change will be the least likely to be noticed to occur, and so consequently, there won't be any forces to object to change. Change is objected to by force, by pressure, that's rajas, by passion, by the mixture of good and evil. But it's when passion subsides to its nadir, with the under the influence of Shiva, bringing down rajas and destroying it and bringing it down to its nadir, that's when change is most likely to occur. But we don't notice it until the surge, or the rise of activity, rises again and reaches the next zenith, and then we compare the zenith of the next wave with the prior one, and we see the difference, and we say, something must have happened. We infer the change happening between the two zeniths, but we don't see it when it happens because it's the time of least excitation, even the time of no excitation. So how can we see a change? We can't. And besides, change is simply that activity is no longer being maintained along the same lines it had been before, and since the change happened at the time when no activity was happening, there's no way you're going to see it. So not only is there no way to perceive it, but because there's no way to perceive it, there's no way to object and prevent it from happening. But that requires, of course, that we make use of the state of least excitation or no excitation, the state of transcending activity entirely. And that's when change occurs, because we've allowed it to occur. So, I think that's what I wanted to add. This may seem irrelevant, but it's not. It's all regarding Tesla's trimetal generator, because whether or not he knew it, it's best that we try to understand it in terms of the three gunas and the doshas, which are the reverberation of the three gunas. And we literally have to understand the mechanics of creation and how creation operates and how the manifestation comes out of the unmanifest and goes back to the unmanifest under the operation of the three gunas, or four gunas, as now we're saying. So knowing that, then we can have the basis upon which to apply that through the agency of the three metals that Tesla used, aluminum, copper, and, well, I should say aluminum, iron, and copper in that order, because that's the sequence of a wave. Rajas, aluminum, tamas, iron, and sattva, copper. So I went online and I looked for I looked for aluminum wire, insulated wire, and I came upon copper-clad aluminum wire. And remembering that high frequency likes to exhibit the skin effect and skip along the surface of the wire, and if you get up the frequency high enough, it'll even skip beyond that and run along the surface of the insulator that's on top of the wire so that nothing goes inside the wire, and that's when you have no current, all voltage, high voltage, high frequency, and no current. So that's kind of wire is standard for audio systems in automobiles. And I thought, oh, that's perfect. At least to try out for my next experiment, to use that as my winding wire around the iron core rather than copper alone, or rather than aluminum alone, or for that matter, copper on one toroid and aluminum on the other. Why not combine the two? I didn't know they were already combined. Now, there is such a thing as silver-clad copper wire, and of course, silver has less resistance than copper. The whole point is to get the energy of the electricity out of the core of the wire and out along the surface where there's less resistance, because it's already become known. It's standard conventional wisdom. So you see, we're coming into Tesla's knowledge. It's just very slow. And nobody wants it to go faster than slow, because that would upset the apple cart and they wouldn't be able to respond in how to exploit the change to stay on top and stay in control. So Tesla was bringing in changes too quickly, and that's why he had to be pushed aside and ignored. Or worse, I don't know. But anyway, so putting copper on top of aluminum would be similar to a lesser degree as putting silver on top of copper, because copper is less resistant than aluminum. That's why copper is standard in the industry for making wire. We don't use other, like iron or aluminum, unless we want to ground something, then maybe we'll use aluminum. But we don't use, because we know it won't rust, and so we don't have to insulate it, and it costs less money. But to have copper-clad aluminum and exhibit that semi-skin effect, at least to be moving in that direction, because the rating on the audio wire for automobiles is rated at megahertz. And that tells me, oh, you see, they're thinking along the same lines of Tesla. So I thought it was perfect. I found on eBay 500 feet of copper-clad aluminum wire, 18-gauge, and for $19, free shipping. I even got my choice of what color insulation, purple or orange or clear. And the clear actually cost a little more money. It was $27 for the roll of 500. Same gauge. So I chose the purple because I figured, you know, I'll go with purple, even though orange is a little flashy. I don't want to be flashy. So I'm waiting for that to arrive. So now I got all these parts, and I got a ring ceramic magnet, permanent magnet. I'm going to try to put in the center of the toroid and have it surround the quartz crystal. So both will be in the center. And I'm going to get rid of the aluminum foil, because I think exposed aluminum might be what the problem is that I'm experiencing. When I had no aluminum in the beginning, it wasn't a problem. And when I brought the aluminum into the system, I started to have problems with fitful sleep at night. And maybe it's because the aluminum is exposed. Because on tin foil, aluminum is on the outside and wax paper is on the inside. That's how they make it. They sandwich three layers. So here I'm going to be doing the reverse. The aluminum will be in the core of the wire and copper will be on top of that, followed by the insulator. So it could be the right way to handle aluminum. It could just be a quirk of the aluminum that you have to handle it the right way. Now, it's interesting, though, that iron is the core of this thing, and it doesn't do any good to have iron wire, but it does a lot of good when it's the core of the toroid, the core of the winding. Regardless of what wire you use to wind around the core, it has to be an iron core, soft iron, magnetizable core. So now we've got two cores. We've got iron at the first core, and we've got aluminum at the core of the wire. And then that means that most of the volume of the wire is going to be aluminum, and very little of it is copper, because it's copper clad. So there's going to be a minimum of copper, which bothered me at first, but then I realized, well, but it's copper clad, maybe it just has to be covered and it'll be okay, and maybe it'll even be better. Who knows? So that made me wonder, well, I always suspected William Lyon's story was that the pistons in his reciprocating pneumatically driven by liquid air turned into compressed air, boiled liquefied air turned into compressed air, that it was an aluminum piston, but I didn't even have a guess what kind of cylinder or tube the piston reciprocated inside of. So now I suspect it's a copper tube. So, yeah, maybe there was special wire wrapped around the iron. See, that this is the next part I don't know about. I may have it backwards. In that, you know, there may be different configurations anyway. Because actually, the winding that I'm devising is simply amounts to being alongside the wire. But essentially, the circuit is the wire itself. That means the aluminum is at the core. And instead of iron picking up the electrostatic charge, the magnetic field of the iron, it's actually the copper now is going to be that picture. And then the iron is outside of the copper. So the layering is now the aluminum is the core, then followed by the aluminum, and then followed by the iron as the last layer of that trimetal sandwich. And that's the sequence. Now, if we made a kind of orgone-like layering, not this way, but some other way, there may be different ways of layering this, see, is what I'm getting to. So, but you have to have the right sequence, and that would be important, I would imagine. Now that's backwards. That's a wave starting at its apex, and instead of falling, it rises. Because then you're going from Rajas to Brahma, rather than Rajas to Tamas, which is more logical, but you're doing it in reverse. It's almost like reverse time, as if you're turning back the clock of time as to how a wave manifests. Because if you start out coming off with a rise, a rajas, a pressure, because that's what rajas is pressure, friction, heat, then I just assumed logically the progression would be that it would then fall, and you'd have Shiva following after Vishnu, and then Brahma after Shiva, the beginning of the next wave. But I could have it backwards in terms of the fact that we're not coming from the unmanifest here, we're coming from the manifest. So everything is turned around. And this is what Charlie said, we'll always get things turned around backwards. Because when you're in the relative, looking to the absolute, everything looks one way. Let's call that a left-handed approach, a left-hand rule. But if you're coming from the absolute, your point of view, your point of reference, and then your field of view is the relative, everything would be backwards from the relative point of view. Everything would be the right-hand rule. So I think that's what the problem is that living in the field of duality, namely the manifest and the unmanifest, not to mention the duality within the manifest world, namely yang and yin, which is a second order of magnitude of duality, which is why we then have triplicity or trinity coming from that dual level of duality, which means we always maintain Purusha as the fourth element, so that's where your quadruplicity comes from. The three gunas plus Purusha makes the foursome, because that's the fourth guna is Purusha, the unmanifest being, existence. But if we're coming from the relative, then we may have to do it in reverse. So what I thought was a logical progression going one way, from Rajas to Tamas to Sattva, we may have to do it the other way around, because we're operating an objective machine using material substances to create an unlimited supply of energy, depending on how much iron we fit into the system to magnify the output. 200 pounds of iron will magnify it by 1 horsepower, 746 watts. So we may have to do it backwards and start with Rajas, but instead of going to Tamas, now we go to Sattva, and then followed by Tamas. So I think that's where the crux of the matter sits, is to view the thing fundamentally correctly, and from there we can then put that into motion. Anybody who's savvy about electrical theory and the application of electrical theory via material sciences, they can then apply it into any way they want to and create an analog with all the parallels to Tesla's trimetal generator without necessarily having to be that exact same device. And I think that's the crux of the matter, is to understand the fundamentals, because it's so fundamental, it literally gets down to Prakriti, the very basis of creation, at the level of the gunas and their reflection, the doshas. So I had it wrong. It has nothing to do with the doshas, because the doshas are the gaps between the gunas. And, you know, the doshas don't exist. They're a mirage. It's what happens when you look at something and you see the reflection of that thing rather than the thing itself. The reflection is the dosha. The reflection of the gunas is the dosha. And the reflection is coming off of Prakriti, off of creation. The gunas are creation. So they are bouncing off of each other, creating reflections off of each other, and those reflections are like the harmonics of a bass tone, in which they're not a true tone. Nobody struck anything to create that tone, and yet, for reasons I still don't understand myself, harmonics get created, harmonic overtones get created from the fundamental that was struck in the first place. I guess it's because, yeah, they ricochet back and forth. The fundamental ricochets back and forth and cross-interferes with itself, breaking up its own self into half-frequency lengths, half-wavelengths, which means its frequency has now been doubled. So it creates its own overtones just by interfering, cross-interfering with itself in a way that did not neutralize itself and nix itself out, you know, entirely. It simply halved itself and halved itself again, and so it's doubled, it's quadrupled, you know, it's all these multiples, whatever. Maybe, I guess, tripled. Yeah, there's odds and evens. Yeah, they're all the natural integer numbers. Depending on the situation, I've learned that, you know, sometimes it's only even multiples and sometimes it's only odd. Depending on the situation, you only get one type of harmonic overtone, like the odds versus the even multiples. But anyway, so it's the gunas bouncing off themselves, off each other, that creates all of these doshas. Without that interaction among the gunas, we'd never have the doshas, you know. We'd just have one pure guna, and it would stand alone all by itself, isolated. And it's the interaction that creates the complexity of all the varying shades of the mixtures of the gunas, which is what doshas are. The mixtures of the gunas are the doshas. So whether I call it reflections or the mixtures or the cross-interference, it amounts to the same thing. Doshas amounts to the same thing. It's the interaction of the gunas with each other. Once creation gets set in motion and maintains, it keeps going in motion, and so it creates all these doshas, which are a mirage. Yet they're real. Just like a beat frequency is a mirage, yet it's real. It's the effect. It's not the cause. Understanding that, then we can understand what the doshas are, and that makes sense. So when we look at the body, we see the results of what the gunas are doing to the body by view of the fact that we're simply diagnosing the body in terms of the doshas without actually seeing what caused it, the gunas themselves. So this is the kind of thinking that we have to understand Tesla's trimetal generator, because we have to reinvent it, and we don't have the lucky background that a few individuals obviously have done so. Two that I've heard of, neither by name, but just by secondhand story. My guest, Joan Bedini, would be my candidate for one of those two people, but I don't know, obviously. I can't say that for sure. That's just a guess, purely speculation on my part. And the other one is a coworker of an engineer dating back quite some years ago. So, and, you know, mysteriously, both people in Washington State, so they may be one and the same person, for all I know. But anyway, be that as it may, this is the kind of thinking we have to understand Tesla's trimetal generator. It's very fundamental, and that's probably why I gravitated towards it, because it's a practical application of understanding the gunas properly, and it's something I didn't understand the gunas properly, so this was really an exercise in understanding the gunas, and that's what it amounts to. And it was because of the help of Bill Verkamp and Philip Nelson and everybody else that has helped me help fertilize my brain so that I can understand better what's going on. And William Lyon, you know, all those people, they helped fertilize. And Eric Dollar, they all helped. I mean, whether I name them or not, they're all deserve the credit. Jai Gurudev.